You're listening to On Subrogation, the litigation podcast about how to recover your damages from the people who caused them. We are your hosts. I'm Rebecca Wright.
And I'm Steve Alsop, and we are both experienced civil litigators and partners at Rathbone Group.
If you have questions or comments during our podcast, please email us at podcast@rathbonegroup.com.
Or you can visit us at our website, rathbonegroup.com.
Okay, Steve, story time. Let me take you back in time a little bit to circa 2003, when I interviewed for a law clerk position while I was still in law school with a firm, and I was interviewing for a litigation law clerk role because as a law student, I knew exactly what that was. I knew that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to go to court and try cases. I was like Captain Mock Trial, and that's what I was going to do. So I had what I thought was a pretty good interview, and I got home, and later that evening, I got a call from the hiring partner who said, you know, we actually need somebody with different hours than you can give us for the litigation clerk role, but we would love to offer you a role as our subrogation law clerk. What do you think of that? And I said, oh, that's really interesting. Can I have 24 hours to think about it, please? And they said, sure. And so I hung up the phone and I got out my Black's Law Dictionary to look up what subrogation was, because I did not recall hearing about that in torts at all. Did you guys cover it in torts?
Absolutely not. Never once.
I don't even think the word was mentioned. But when I did look it up in Black's Law Dictionary, and I will have you know that I have that same Black's Law Dictionary here right now, that same one, the same version and everything. And so when I looked it up on that fateful night, what I read was this. Subrogation is a noun, and it means the substitution of one party for another whose debt the party pays, entitling the paying party to rights, remedies, or securities that would otherwise belong to the debtor. For example, a surety who has paid a debt is, by subrogation, entitled to any security for the debt held by the creditor and the benefit of any judgment the creditor has against the debtor and may proceed against the debtor as the creditor would. Good. Podcast done, right?
I can see you as a law clerk reading that and going, oh, yeah, got it. Done.
That's exactly how that went.
I'm going to go in there and just crush this.
I feel like you've encountered quite a bit of this, too, as we've been interviewing law clerks for our firm nowadays.
We've come full circle now, and now I'm of course, helping you and doing the law clerk interviews for our Cincinnati office. This last year, I think I've interviewed 15 law students. Every single one of them, I do the same thing. I ask them, so when did you find out what subrogation was? And did you look it up last night? And every single one has laughed and said, yes, as soon as I saw the posting for this job, I had to get the dictionary out and look up what subrogation actually is because, you know, of course, our firm is hiring subrogation law clerks and no one knows what that is. Even kids that have been in school for 3 years, the three L's, have no idea.
Well, even more embarrassing, about a couple of years into my marriage, my husband admitted that for about the first 3 years that we were dating, he thought that I was saying that I practiced segregation law. And that just begs the question, what side of that argument did he think that I was on exactly?
In his mind, what did you do all day?
Right.
And also, do you have a speech impediment?
I don't think so. I always wonder, was I pro-segregation or anti-segregation in his mind? We'll never know. Now he understands. And I think we understand what is subrogation. I mean, my understanding of it when I'm trying to explain it to the law clerks that I interview is that it is stepping into the shoes of another party. And what we are specifically talking about is subrogation in the insurance context, but we find subrogation in many other contexts as well.
That's absolutely true. The history of subrogation is as an equitable remedy, and it's first developed in the English Court of Chancery. It is where our common law in the United States was derived, and it's a court of equity in England and Wales that followed a loose set of rules to avoid the slow pace of change and harshness of the common law at the time.
I'm pretty sure you have to say all that with an English accent.
I can't possibly do that. It would be insulting to
Englishmen everywhere.
It would be insulting to Englishmen, and it would be embarrassing for me. But I'm going to give you a long quote from the Magna Carta. It appears that the concept of subrogation was actually incorporated into the common law in the Magna Carta, which was the basis of the common law, 1,000 years ago. And the Magna Carta states as follows. And I'm not doing the accent. Neither we nor our bailiffs shall seize any land or rent for any debt, so long as the debtor's chattels are sufficient to discharge the same, nor shall the debtor's sureties be distrained, so long as the debtor is able to pay the debt. If the debtor fails to pay, not having the means to pay, then the sureties shall answer the debt, and if they desire, they shall hold the debtor's lands and rents until they have received satisfaction of the debt for which they have paid him, unless the debtor can show that he has discharged his obligation to them. So that is the formal basis for a subrogation concept. One person is standing in the shoes of another to collect money that they have paid, and it's an equitable concept, basically, holding the person responsible for the debt that they owe.
Right, and it can also mean, and does also mean, that you are assuming the rights of the person for whom you are making the payments. So we mentioned that subrogation comes up not just in the insurance context, but in other contexts as well. So when we are talking about property liens and property rights, if somebody pays somebody else's property lien off, then they can actually become the primary lien holder in that instance, and they can jump ahead of other lien holders on the basis of making that payment. There are a lot of exceptions to that and things, but that's another instance of subrogation.
And that is equitable subrogation, and it happens automatically as a kind of a operation of law.
Mm-hmm. But we, of course, are talking about insurance subrogation. That is our focus, our firm's focus. And when we discuss insurance subrogation, what we are talking about is when an insurance company, on the basis of the insurance contract, makes a payment to their policyholder for damages that are caused by somebody else, by a tortfeasor. And that gives the insurance company the right, the subrogation right, to pursue the money damages that were paid out from that tortfeasor as if they were the insured. So they're stepping into the shoes of their own insured, and they assume the rights of that insured. They also, of course, assume the liabilities of their insured as well. So if the insured is determined to be liable, then the insurance company cannot recover from that tortfeasor either.
This is an operation of contractual subrogation, because the subrogation actually arises based on the contract between the parties, which is the subrogation language in the policy. And this is also called conventional subrogation.
That's right.
And there is also statutory subrogation, where it's a mechanism that gives a carrier a right to recover certain benefits. Statutory subrogation may arise in areas such as workers' comp, hospital liens, and Medicare, as well as other things. It's a mechanism of law to ensure that the carrier gets paid money that it had to pay out, based on a statute.
Absolutely. And in the context of insurance, we find subrogation and subrogation rights for all types of different policies and claims. So whether it be an automobile policy, workers' compensation, health, property and casualty, even bonds and things like that can all mm-hmm. become subject to, or all can be recovered within the context of insurance subrogation.
And the claimant's rights here, as you mentioned, are wholly derivative of the insured's. There's no other rights. They don't have higher rights than the person that they are subrogated to, and they have no fewer rights, basically. If they pay the claim, they're subrogated to the insured for that amount.
There are certain contexts where those rights get passed directly by statutory operation from the insured to the insurance company. I'm thinking in terms of, say, Kentucky PIP law, where we have a specific statute that says that the insurance company, once they pay out that PIP, they now own the right to that claim for the recovery of the PIP, and the insured no longer has any rights with regard to that claim. And that's an anomaly, rather, in the law as it goes with regard to claims and subrogation.
And as you and I both know, Kentucky PIP law is probably an entirely separate podcast.
We could do a whole separate podcast on Kentucky PIP law, and three people would listen to it.
Three people would be enthralled by it.
Your mom, my mom, yes. Well, why don't we talk about some examples of subrogation in these different contexts?
Absolutely. The first is the property context, a property policy. So if you have a property policy that covers your property, either at your house or your a building you own, or you know, any property, and it's covered by insurance, if your insurer pays for damages that are caused to that property, they are then entitled to seek recovery from the person who caused the property damage. Any person or organization to or for whom the insurer makes a payment has the right to recover damages from the other. Those rights are transferred to the insurer to the extent of the payment. So if you cause me $10,000 damage to my property, my insurance company pays for the $10,000 damage, and then they would have the right to seek $10,000 from the person who caused that damage. And to give you an example, let's say you own a condo on the first floor of a building, and another person, let's call him Bob, he owns a condo on a floor above yours. One day, Bob leaves his faucet on in his bathtub, and he leaves for work. The tub overflows, the water comes through your ceiling and damages the ceiling, your hardwood floors, your subfloor, your flat-screen TV is ruined. Your property insurer will reimburse you for the damage that's caused to your property. And because it has indemnified you for the loss, it assumes your right to sue Bob for that damage. So then your insurance company will take Bob to court and try to recover the damage that he caused because he left the faucet on.
That's right. And that would be an indirect action on the basis of subrogation.
It would. And the rights of your insurance company are to recover for Bob's negligence. Basically, the rights that they have are the rights that you would have had to sue Bob for the negligence because he caused damage to you. But since they've made that payment, now they have the claim to bring against Bob for his negligence in leaving the faucet running.
You would also have the right to go after other contractors and things that may have been involved, other subs, other employees and things like that, correct? Mm-hmm. You would also have the right to go after others who may be found to have contributed to the negligence or contributed to the damage in some way. So let's say that during the course of the investigation, you find out that Bob actually did turn off the faucet, but that his plumber who had worked on his faucet the week before had improperly reconnected the plumbing, and that is what actually caused the water damage down into your insured's unit, then at that point you could go after the plumber as well. Really, it's any tort claim. We go after the tortfeasor who actually caused that incident.
That's correct. And that would be another example of negligence as well if it were against a plumber because the plumber would have performed his job negligently.
That's right. Now let's talk about the auto context. So this is the one that I usually use in my elevator speech to new people I'm meeting who ask what I do. Mm-hmm. they say, what do you do? I'm an attorney. Well, what kind of law do you practice? I practice insurance subrogation. And then I wait patiently for them to say, what is that? And generally I use the auto example of, let's say that you are driving down the street and you are heading through an intersection on a green light and some yahoo, let's call him Bob, comes careening through the red light and T-bones your car. Then your insurance company is going to pay you for your damages, and then they will have the right to pursue Bob and or his insurance company for the damages that they pay out as a result of Bob's negligence.
That's correct. The pursuit will be against Bob directly. If Bob has insurance, great. Let's hope that they step in and make that payment on Bob's behalf. If Bob doesn't have insurance, Bob will be on the hook personally.
That's right.
For the damage he caused to you, and he'll have to pay that directly to the subrogated insurance company.
How about workers' compensation? Let's talk about some examples of workers' compensation subrogation.
Workers' compensation subrogation works the same way as the other subrogation contexts. It's just dependent on who makes the payment. If it's a workers' comp policy, so if you have a business with an employee and the employee is hurt on the job and you have to pay, you being an insurance company, have to pay a workers' compensation policy. If the damages to that worker were caused by a third party, either through negligence or, say, a product defect or any kind of other claim that causes physical harm to that person, then you are subrogated to recover those damages.
And we've actually seen several of these cases, but it's important to note that workers' compensation subrogation is very strictly construed by the various workers' compensation statutes, and it differs from state to state. So the extent of the insurance company's ability to recover and rights to recover in subrogation are typically dictated by the workers' compensation code. The venue in which you can, as an insurance company, recover is dictated by the code, and whether you come before or come after, the insured's rights with that regard, get paid first monies, last monies, and what role you get to pay in the recovery process is also dictated very strictly by the workers' compensation code in the individual state in which the workers' compensation action is being brought.
But we can give a couple of examples. So the easiest example you could give in a workers' compensation context would be just to substitute the same example we gave in the auto context. If you had a person who is driving as a part of their job and they're on the job and they're driving. Say it's a delivery worker or a pizza delivery worker or something like that, and they are involved in an automobile accident and it's 100% the other person's fault. Let's say the tortfeasor's name is Bob and he runs a red light and hits the pizza delivery driver and causes him $10,000 in personal injury. The injury would be paid under the workers' compensation policy, and then the workers' compensation carrier would have a right to recover that money from Bob, who caused the injury.
So this all comes down to tort law, because essentially these cases that we've been talking about have been tort cases, but there is subrogation in other contexts as well. Like we mentioned, there are bond subrogation cases, and those are contractual cases. There are subrogation cases for other violations of contract, for products liability, things like that. So any claim that your insured has that the insurance company pays out on has the potential for subrogation claim and subrogation recovery. So then we get into, why do we do all this? Why is there such thing as insurance subrogation law, and most importantly, insurance subrogation lawyers? And there are really three main purposes to insurance subrogation. First and foremost, I think, is the issue of fairness and justice. Insurance subrogation seeks to make the wrongdoer responsible for the loss that occurred, as opposed to shifting that to the insurance company. You know, the idea is, why should our insurer be paying for damage that is caused by other people via their insurance policies? It's an argument that I make in court quite a bit when judges try to tell me, you know, well, shouldn't the policy premiums cover these losses? It's like, well, why should they, Your Honor? Why should the insurance companies be the one who are bearing this on the backs of their insureds? And going along with that is the second purpose, is that it keeps insurance premiums down. When we can recover in subrogation from tortfeasors who cause damages, then it helps to keep the insurance premiums down across the board. And finally, it does prevent double recovery to the insured. So in the context of a personal injury action, it helps to make sure that the recovery that the insured gets for damages that were paid out by somebody else, like an insurance company, those recoveries go back to the party that actually paid for the damages, as opposed to a double recovery for the insured.
Subrogation also allows insurance companies to recover a significant portion of the money they pay out in the event of a claim, which, as you mentioned, does keep the premiums down, and it shifts the cost to at-fault drivers and their insurance companies. So overall, it serves the same interest as the public policy behind any kind of tort law, in that it makes people who are poor drivers or otherwise negligent, causing damages to other people, it makes them responsible in the long run. And it also helps with your insurance company running their business and keeping you on the road if you're a driver, because if the other side is slow to pay or if they're uninsured and don't pay, your insurance company steps up, makes the payment, puts you back as whole as they can, as fast as they can, and then your insurance company will shoulder the burden of taking that person to court and try to recover that money. So it provides a buffer between you, the driver, and the legal system if you are hurt and you don't have any way to get the money from the other person.
Well, this is one of those topics where there are so many more avenues that we could get down. And really, that's going to be the focus of this podcast for the most part, are these different avenues of subrogation and how this plays out in the legal context, the insurance context, negotiations, and so on and so forth. For more information on different ways that subrogation can be practiced, I do encourage you to go to our website at rathbonegroup.com, where we have some detailed descriptions of other practice areas where we apply these subrogation principles. Anything else on subrogation, Steve?
There's so much else on subrogation. But that's a bird's eye view of what subrogation means as a concept.
Well, if you have any questions about anything that we've discussed today, if you'd like to suggest a topic for a future podcast, or you have some comments about today's topic, or you'd like to refer some files, please feel free to email us at podcast@rathbonegroup.com.
And again, visit our website, rathbonegroup.com.
Well, that's it for today. Until next time.